Laurie, I'm just going to introduce you formally. Some of you already had the opportunity to chat with you, I know. But so I'm formally welcoming you, Laurie Barrett, to the Crone Power interview. And what we're going to be talking about today is how to follow your passion and purpose while being a primary caregiver for somebody. I think this is such a brilliant topic because, even if we have had times, or even if currently we're not a primary caregiver for somebody, there is very likely going to we're going to arrive at that time in our life when we need care from somebody else. And so even if we're not a caregiver right now, this can help us to reflect upon how we want to show up as somebody who has somebody who's helping us as a primary caregiver. So I'm going to just share a little bit about Laurie first of all. So Laurie is an entrepreneur. She's a published number one best-selling author, and her book, I do have it up here somewhere. Let me just say, I know. Here we go. If not now, then when? Live the best of your life for the rest of your life by reaching towards your passion and purpose. Fabulous. And I think the links to that were in the email, and they're certainly going to be in the replay email. Laurie's also a spiritual life coach, and she specializes in intuitive transformation. She's just got so many expert experiences in her life, degrees in social work, behavioral science, ongoing training in life coaching. She has more than 35 years of experience with families. She's a past educator, a family involvement advisor with the school system. She's retired from criminal justice. She is the founder and president of Laurie Barrett Enterprises, LLC. And whilst all of that has been going on, she's been a caregiver for the majority of her life, and she has succeeded in following her passions and purpose throughout this time of being a caregiver to many. So, welcome, Laurie.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Good to be here with all of you. I see so many bright faces popping up.
Good. So, I would like to just set the context here because I was so impressed with you. When I met you, you were creating your life coaching business. So this was some years ago. And at the same time, you were looking after your mother who was very ill. And I was endlessly impressed by your kindness, your persistence as well. And I just wonder if you would like to start by just sharing a little bit about that experience before we get onto the purpose and the passion.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, my mom, just a little bit of background. I grew up with my mom. My mom and dad got divorced when I was two. So it was more my mom before my stepdad came on the scene later when I was like 11. And unfortunately, my mom was an alcoholic. So I brought that up just to say it was quite the childhood. Parts of it were great, most of it not so much for me and my one sister. But later in life, speeding up to what Allison said, my mom, I don't think she was ever diagnosed properly. I think she had what's called borderline personality disorder. And so once the Alzheimer's set in, it kind of took that to a whole new level. I was used to dealing with that with her, and sometimes, to be honest, not knowing exactly what personality you were talking to. So the Alzheimer's actually, and this is going to sound crazy probably because she did have aggression with it, but it actually made her nicer. And so once she couldn't afford anymore, and I couldn't afford to help her anymore with the short stays a couple years she had in assisted living, which is, if anyone knows, is just so expensive, at least here in the United States. So brought her into our home. I was still raising my twin girls. They were in high school at this time. And my one twin was very ill as well. And then she started getting better after a couple years. So I kind of had them both at the same time. And then once she started getting better, my mom, of course, started getting worse. So I kept my mom for about 6 years. Yeah, it was 6 years, before I just couldn't do it anymore. She needed more care than what I could give. And I was giving her the 24/7 care, but it got to the point where she needed more like a nursing situation. So I did it as long as I could. And in the meantime, during that period, I didn't want to lose some of my own dreams and passions. So that's when what Allison had mentioned, I started my own business. Right before that, before my mom came to stay with us, I had a restaurant at one time, actually, my husband and I. And that was closed down. And that's when I took my mom in to help her. And I thought to myself, you know, I want to do this for her, but I don't want to lose myself in the meantime. So I decided to take the 2 degrees I already had. What did I want to do? I thought about doing a master's program, but then when my daughter got sick, it was just taking too much care, for that. And then mom came on board, and I thought, no, I'm not going to go back to college. I want to do something different. I want to help people in another way. And that's when I got into the life coaching, training. And it's been a blessing. I've been able to help a lot of people. And I just feel like the moment you let go of who you are or your dreams or your passions is the moment that life is going to change. And that can be at any age. And I also found out through this that I grew as a person because there's many passions. A lot of times people think, oh, it's one thing. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And as we evolve, especially as women, that's not always true. And so I've actually gotten into some other things besides the life coaching in addition to. So yeah, that was kind of that period of my life. My mom passed, let's see, next month will be 2 years. And I'll be honest, it was a lot. It was a lot. I wrote my book during that time, and you're going to say, how in the world did you do that? Because mom, you know, she needed serious care. She wasn't bedridden yet, but everything but that. And so I would just take 15 minutes here, a half an hour there, you know, however it worked, and it ended up working. And I published the book in 2020. Actually, I published the book as I was getting over the first COVID. And I even thought to myself, I was taking care of my husband, he was trying to take care of me. And I thought to myself, this is not going to work. This is not going to be good because everybody's, you know, inside and nobody's out and nobody's going to work and all. And then my intuition told me, no, this is the perfect time. This is actually the perfect time. So I went ahead and published, but it was difficult, but you can do it. You can do whatever it is.
So I wanted to ask you, I mean, I remember, how involved you were with looking after your mum. And it was physically very demanding, and it was, I remember, it was just It was you were on call, and you knew that you had to respond whenever she needed you. And it was, I just remember just how totally, like I said, so kind you were, and so generous. And to me, it's just so amazing that the first thing that you managed to keep your passion, you managed to keep that flame lit, because it would be very easy under that pressure, and you had, your mother and your daughter, and like you said, you weren't working outside the house either. I mean, I know some people manage to do that. The time pressure must be so much, but then it meant that you were also very much, within the house. And so I just wonder, how do we keep that flame, that passion alive when the pressure of caring for others, and it can be parents, it could be partners. I mean, I've met women in the crone circles who are full-time, who are, struggling with their own ill health, and are full-time carers for their partner. There's people who are carers for their grandchildren, carers for their children, carers for their parents. So it's like huge, and it's very easy, I feel, for us to go under that weight. How do we keep the passion? How do we remain true to that?
Well, I think when we recognize the difference between, in my opinion, what passion is and what purpose is. Passion is what drives you. You wake up in the morning, what's the first thing you think about doing or wanting to become or wanting to do with your life? Purpose is more of what calls you. What you feel in your gut. I have to do this in life. I have to do this for people. And in the same time, it's hard because if you marry the two, that's what I believe is authentic to each individual. In the same respect, you can't lose yourself. You must find ways, whatever that is, and whatever that means to you, to self-care, to self-promote. And one of the best things I've ever heard that always stuck with me is, how would you treat your best friend? Make yourself your best friend. A lot of times we're very kind to people. We would do anything for people. We go the extra mile for whoever, our children, our friends, our family, sometimes co-workers. And we, as women especially, we put ourselves on that back burner all the time. Don't do that anymore if you're doing that. You are just as important as anyone else you're caregiving for or you're trying to help. And I think that's so important to keep as much as possible in your forefront of your mind. And I think it makes all the difference because, like I said, if we don't do that, we really can't take care of anyone else properly or 100%. You have to take care of you first, just like you have to love yourself first before you can give to others. An analogy I was told, this is some years back when I was raising my twins and I worked full time in the criminal justice system, which is very stressful. And I had decided I had never had the opportunity to go to college. And I had been married twice at that time. My second husband passed away. And I was determined that was something, one of my passions I always wanted to do. And I was determined I was going to do it. And I did. I did accelerated degrees in 28 months. I've always been the kind of person that I just go for things. I just, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it 150%. And I remember someone telling me, I was kind of pretty stressed out at the time, trying to get it all figured out. And I remember someone told me, you're like, it's like a parking garage, and there's no more room in the garage, but cars keep coming in. And you have to take time to breathe, and you have to take time to be present in the moment, and you have to take time for you. Yes, you're doing the college degrees for you. Yes, you're raising your twins. Yes, and you have to go to work. But what else can you do to make sure that you're okay? And these are some of the questions I started asking myself, and that's when I thought, yeah, I really need to look at this a little differently, to have a different perspective.
So, would you say then, from what you're saying, it's like the self-care really comes first before the passion and purpose. The self-care,
I believe so.
yeah, comes first.
Wholeheartedly. And I was doing it the opposite for quite a few years until I figured that out. And that analogy of the parking garage started making perfect sense. The cars were still coming in and they were starting to wreck into each other. There's no more room. So what do? You have to start emptying some things out and filling it back up with the things that matter the most. And one of them has to be you.
I think that's so important because it's like you said, exactly like you said, we're used to putting ourselves, our self-care on the back burner, our own needs, even basic needs, we're used to putting them at the bottom of the list. And that could be, it could be for anything. It could be for work or community groups that we're involved in, or it could be anything. We keep it's something that is so we've learned that our needs are less important than other needs of other people, whoever that is.
Yes.
And so for me, it's like, okay, so it's very It's one thing for us to grasp that because as you were talking, I was thinking, about that image we all know that they say on the airplane, put your oxygen on first before you put
Exactly.
it on anybody else. And we know that, rationally we know it, but it is so hard to do. So, how do we overcome that? Especially when if we're caregiving, we might be, that. The other person's needs come first. It's like we've been living that as a broken record. So how do we put ourselves in the, how do we take care of ourselves? How do we really move from the rational understanding to the doing of it?
I think a couple of things come to mind. One of the biggest things, and this is something I've learned, and once you learn something, you usually have it, but that doesn't mean that a new day won't try that. In other words, to be in the present moment is something I've learned. But not every day do I do that perfectly. Most days I do now. But that is key because we can't do anything about yesterday and we're not promised tomorrow. I think we've all learned that, especially from COVID, when we're not promised tomorrow. So you have to live in today. You have to live in the moment even. And sometimes I've even had to talk myself into, okay, even this hour, even this minute, just concentrate on this minute, is so important. And I think that makes a huge difference because women, a lot of times we multitask because we've had to, but actually that's not the best way to do, I found out, because you're never giving 100% to one thing. And just a small example, okay, so we're putting the laundry in while we're cooking dinner while we're answering somebody's question, the phone rings, now we're on the phone, you know. That will stretch you to a point of, I think, burnout. So I've learned as much as possible, one task at a time, or even just two tasks at a time. That's it. Be present in that moment. Whatever I'm doing, do that at that time. So I think that's so important. I also think that I've found in my own self, and I've, you know, some of my girlfriends and whatnot, women, we don't like to delegate, especially if you have the perfectionist spirit, which has been one of my biggest battles in life. Get that from mom. And she got it from her dad, so it's passed down, and my one daughter has it bad. But when you have that, you have to learn it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to ask, you know, your daughter to run upstairs with your mom's lunch just to have a breather. You know, you made the lunch. Can you please run it upstairs? You know, just need 10 minutes here. It's okay to do that. And I wasn't doing a lot of that until probably like the last year and a half that mom was with us. And it will exhaust you not to delegate. And you know, even on your job, we all learn how to do that usually. But I was of the mindset for so long, well, I want to do it because I know it'll get done right.
Yeah.
isn't that a prideful statement? Like
I
nobody
totally
else can do
identify
it
with
right
that.
but you, right? And so I've learned some of those. I'm not going to call them faults, weaknesses, maybe, that I was becoming exhausted because I'm doing it all. Well, why are you doing it all? I mean, I was still doing most of it, but you can ask somebody to run up and bring her a drink. You can, you know, when she did come downstairs, when she was having an alert day, she'd be up and down the stairs about 35 times a day, asking the same questions and all that. You know, that becomes exhausting. So maybe I'd let one of my daughters or my husband, you know, can you take this little shift here and answer that question for me again, please? I'm going to go to the restroom for five, just
Yeah.
to breathe. So I think the present moment, delegating, asking people for help is so important. And the third thing that comes to my mind is just knowing you can only do your best for that day. You can only do your best, and whatever your best is good enough, because you know, technically we could all say, I don't have to do any of this. Let somebody else do it. Put her in a home. Do this, you know, the children are older, you know, when they're babies, that's different, but they're older now, they can do this, that, and the other. Learn how to start appreciating yourself in knowing that, hey, I'm as important too. I'm just as important. It's okay. I did the best I could that day. I don't need to feel guilty about anything. So you didn't get maybe four things done on your to-do list. It's okay. The world didn't end. And these are the things I would tell myself to help myself. So I hope some of that helps you all.
I'm sure it really will. I mean, I find it helpful just hearing you say it, and it's such wisdom and really quite easy to apply, but we forget. We're just so caught up in that, you know, I've got to do it all, and nobody else can do it quite as well as I can do it, and they'll do it wrong, and then I'll just have to do it again, and all that kind of thing, you know, what was coming up for me was that a few things, but mainly that we tend to see when we're caregivers, especially when we're the primary caregivers, we tend to polarize these two things, don't we? Like, I'm the caregiver, and that's my life over there, what I really want to be doing, if we're lucky enough to have that clarity about what we want to do, because, you know, many of us are in a place where we're not clear about what we want to do. But we tend to see them as oppositional rather than finding any way that they can both coexist in our precious time.
That's very true. And I think something too, with you saying that, Allison, is a lot of times I think we weigh success as if we're never supposed to fail at something. And actually, I've learned that failure is the only way to really learn success. And if that's something simple like, okay, today I didn't get those things done on my to-do list, that doesn't make you a failure. You failed because you didn't maybe get everything that was on your list, but looking from a whole different perspective, how much stuff did you put on that list? 25, 30 things. There's no way that would have gotten done in a day.
It's true.
So that's helped me a lot with that. You're going to fail sometimes with things, but that doesn't make you a failure. And
Yeah.
a lot of times too, different cultures, different parts of the world, how we're raised, all of that comes into play, because we're all individuals, we're all women, we have that in common, but we're all individuals and we all come from a certain place, a certain upbringing, maybe a certain country, a certain culture, and all of that forms us. So then we're all different. But the primary goal is you're not a failure. You're not a failure. And success to me is measured by what I learn when I do fail in something. Or perhaps when I don't do what I, or it didn't turn out the way I thought it should. And so then I start looking at it from a different perspective. And I cover some of that in the book, even as, okay, I'm sitting in this chair, I'm looking at all of you. When we get off this call, if I go and sit in that chair that's to my left, you can't see a rocking chair, it's going to make me look this way. So the whole room looks different. It's the same way with our lives and how we go about our day-to-day circumstances. Because my pressure might be totally different from your pressure. Sherry was sharing with me about her husband's hip. I've never dealt with that. I've dealt with a lot of other things, but I've never dealt with that. So I don't know what that's like. So she has that certain kind of pressure that only she knows that her husband and her are dealing with. So in her day, she's going to look at things from that perspective right now. So I think all of that really makes a difference. I really do.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I'm so pleased that you brought that in because we can forget that and we can start judging ourselves and finding ourselves wanting according to this, I don't know, like a stereotypical image of being dutiful daughters or I don't know, whoever, whatever stereotype image we want to sort of be holding on to in any moment, we very rarely are going to say, oh yeah, I'm a champion at this, we're going to measure up against this. And what you're and find ourselves wanting, and what you're reminding us is how really totally pointless that is, because each of us have such a unique situation and story and upbringing and everything, context and everything. There's something else that I wanted to ask you, which keeps coming up as well. And this
Sure.
might be one of the last questions I ask you, actually, is about feeling okay about saying no. Like whether there's a time in the caregiving relationship where you just feel that what's happening for you is that it has to be a no and you have to find another solution, or I don't know, just that ability to actually say, no, I can't do this any longer. Whatever that means, it might mean like, finding other people to come in and help, or whatever. But that big no, I mean, it's full of guilt, and it's very difficult to arrive at that. And I wonder, what your views are on that, and if we feel that and we don't respect it, what are the consequences?
I think some of that comes in if you're a people pleaser, which I was early on. I still like to please people, but I don't do it to my detriment now. I had to learn how to say no. And no can be said in a lot of different ways. If you're dealing, I found, with somebody in my family, like my mom, or you all are dealing with somebody in your family, or maybe a friend, someone that isn't necessarily easy to say no to. You know, there's going to be a problem when you say no. I found different ways to say no, like, oh, I would love to help you, but I'm going to have to pass this time. Or I have a lot on my plate this week. Maybe we could do that again another time, but I just can't. My schedule doesn't permit it this time. You know, and I found all kinds of different ways. Sometimes you want to say just no, but there's a way to say it without hopefully offending someone. You know, there were some times where I wanted to say, absolutely not. You know, but you don't want to necessarily go there with people, because the whole point of them asking you, I found, is usually twofold. Either they really do need help, or they're the type of person that just wants you to do a lot for them that they could even do for themselves, or they could go ask somebody else. So you have to decide, where is that no coming in? Where is that no need to be said, and how to say it? A lot of times, when I would, what I call, kind of cushion it, or say it in one of the ways I just said, it would go over much better. It would go over well. I still got the no out without the argument coming, or without the displeasure on their face. Because what I had to learn was, I'm doing a whole lot for everybody already, and to keep making sure that I keep myself as important, you have to say no sometimes. You have to, because if you don't, you're going to be trying to give to them from that empty place again, and you're going to get burnt out. It is very easy and can be very dangerous to get burnt out. And I think that's where a lot of times the anxiety, the stress, and depression come in. You know, just an example is, and this isn't judging anyone, but you hear parents sometimes saying, especially if their kids are kind of like, 10, 11 in there, maybe a little younger, oh, I'm so busy. I'm so busy. I'm so busy. Well, let's look at why you're busy. Well, Johnny's going to football practice, and Susie has ballet, and Sandy has gymnastics, and I just have so much to do, and I'm on the PTA. I got to make cupcakes for her class. On and on and on. Stop and just look at that. How many things could you have said no to? Or maybe it's too much. One child or two get to go to this time. The other child may be something different that doesn't take up as much time, because now you're just functioning for the get-togethers, the sports, the, you know what I mean? And so I think that's a great example of, yeah, you want your child to be involved in things, but you have to say no to some things. Okay, so Susie has the ballet class. I'm sorry, I can't make cupcakes this time, maybe next time. And that's a small example. I hope that doesn't sound trivial, but you know, that's your day-to-day life. You know, especially at work, it's really hard, because if your boss is saying, like some of mine did, I, you know, there's all these piles when is this going to get done, or how come you didn't do, McCallahan's case or whatever it is. It's very hard when you're dealing with bosses to say no. So I found ways in that respect of saying, because I'm working on Mr. Smith, you said he was a rush job. McCallahan's right after him. Oh, okay. Sometimes just saying it in a different way
Yeah,
helps.
I like that.
It helps.
And also, I suppose you could use the same sort of more gentle way of saying no if you choose to, because I'm thinking about, a lot of people who are caring for their partners, for example, and then their partners become more ill. Example, what I have in my head is a friend of mine, her parents, the two of them living alone, and she was a very small woman, he was a very large man, and they were getting on in years. She was losing her eyesight, and he had Parkinson's, and she became his primary caregiver, and she could hardly do anything. She was so small, she had her own needs, and so that ability to actually recognize the garage, we're the garage, and we have our own self-care. But to be able to say, no, I actually can't do this, or even I don't want to do this.
Which is okay too.
And that, I think that's quite a hard thing. So I like your sort of, like, if we focus on the small things, practicing saying no in ways which are coming from, no, I can't do it, which is where I get to. Like, I'm so exhausted. No, I can't.
Oh,
We
yeah.
don't want to reach that. We need to find different ways, and we can practice doing the small things, but then maybe it becomes easier when it's those really big things as well.
It's so true. And believe me, I've been where you just said, where it's like, I'm pulling my hair out. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my, how much am I supposed to take with helping? Perfect example. I've been married, well, married my third time now. And my second husband, he developed liver cancer, unfortunately. We found out he was sick 2 months after we got married. It wasn't cancer then, but it was bad. And then it developed into that. And then it metastasized, so it was a mess. And my stepdad, who was very precious to me and helped raise me, more into my tweens and teenage years, also developed cancer. His was skin cancer, squamous, I think you call it, a skin cell cancer behind his ear, which also then metastasized. So they both had cancer at the same time. And I was still working full time in criminal justice, and I had the twins. And it was hard because I was an hour away from work at the time, from where I lived and where I had, where I was working. And where I was working is where my stepdad lived. And where I lived, obviously, is where my husband was. And I was driving back and forth trying to help my mother, trying to help my husband, trying to help my stepdad, on and on. And my one sister, I have two, but my one that's also from my mom, she wasn't doing anything. And I got to the point where I finally just called her up one day and I said, "You're up." Because I had gotten to that point, there was no, I wasn't nasty, but I was just like, "You're up." I can't do both, and I have to take care of my husband. They ended up dying 3 months apart. But when I did that, that's when she stepped up. And even though my mom and I both had hospice for our patients, hospice isn't there all the time when you have it in your home. And so I was at the point, like you're saying, where it got to the point where, I can't do all this anymore. And that's okay. It's okay for me to say no. It's okay for me to say, hey, I can't do all this anymore. And the same thing with my mom, even though it was really hard, I knew when it got to the point where she needed more care than I could give her. And I recognized that. And for a little while, I still tried. I tried, still keeping her, And then I realized she needs help. She needs more help than I can do, because she was incontinent for a long, long time, and had to make sure she took her medicine. She would lie and say she took her medicine, but I had to stand there and look under her tongue, just all that kind of stuff. And you have to get to the point where it's okay. Some people don't even try to take care of their parents. You did the best you could. You did the best you could. And then once, unfortunately, I put her in assisted living again, it was memory care at that point. She went downhill really fast, which was a shame, like within a year, But I had to tell myself, that's not your fault. You gave her a whole lot of years that she wouldn't have had, I don't believe. Even when we moved her from where she was to the state we were in at the time, because we had moved, she was eating, rotten food out of her fridge. She was leaving the oven on, all that kind of stuff. She probably would have been dead a long time ago. So I looked at it that way. I gave her the best that I could give her. But you have to get to the point where you know that you have to say, okay, that's it for me. I can't. It's not that you don't want to, but you can't. And that's okay. It's okay. Because, as women too, we feel so guilty about everything a lot of the time. If I don't help this person to the point of putting myself down, it's not okay. I feel guilty. But guess what? If you put yourself down, you're not helping anybody because you're done.
Oh, wow. Oh, Laurie, I could just talk with you forever about this. I want to open it now, though, to the discussion.